O'Clock, Season 5 of the Telly Award-winning podcast. Coming at you like Detective James Sonny Crockett of the Miami Metro-Dade Police Department. Living on this sailboat with our pet alligator Elvis. Clearing our desks of other cases just so we can make your life a living hell. Whew, man. We're both a little ill right now. Yep. That took a lot out of me. So I'm going to slow down right now and tell you that I'm Ryland Grant, screenwriter, Ringo Award-winning creator of fine comics like Aberrant, Banjax, and The Jump. The other voice in the dark, the man who is a little bit more sick than I am, the man in the box to your left is...
he said, David Avalone, writer, coffee achiever, still suffering from con crud. Thank you, San Diego.
Con crud. If you missed any of our previous conversations, episodes featuring panels from San Diego Comic-Con 2024 and conversations with comic luminaries like David F. Walker, Matt Fraction, Stan Sakai, Kevin Eastman, Rodney Barnes, and many, many more. Our entire catalog can be celebrated via YouTube, Apple Pods, and other purveyors of worthwhile ear cracks, so double on back and check all that out. We have a great show today. One of our favorite people coming on to chop it up about his new enterprise. But do you have anything to promote, to pimp?
I think on the day that this drops will be Drawing Blood number 5.
Nice.
You know, we did this as a Kickstarter years ago, and issues 1 through 4 therefore have been out there for a really long time, but issue 5 is the brand new stuff and brings us into a new arc, and it's our middle arc of 12. It's our Empire Strikes Back. It's our darkness, and our hero goes to Hollywood to watch the gritty reboot of his adorable 90s indie comic being shot on a soundstage in Hollywood. So it's good, clean, wholesome American fun. That's what I. What do you got going on?
Nice. A lot of good stuff right now. So my film Haunted Heart, from Academy Award winning director Fernando Trueba and actor Matt Dillon, that opens up in Spain this week. So exciting. Big bad.
So Jim Chadwick, go check it out.
Go check it out. And then, and then it'll be released, already have a UK date in September and, United States in the fall. So coming soon. I also have, it should be, I think next week there will be the new Kickstarter announcement. So new title, new Jump-esque, Black Mirror-esque sci-fi joint that is gonna blow your doors off. So watch the socials for that. But yeah, I think that's everything. Why don't we bring Chris on and make things more interesting?
Let me bring in Chris Longo.
Howdy, howdy.
Hey, Chris. Good to see you.
Good to see you too.
Well, coughing but alive.
Ryland, if that's how you sound when you're sick, that intro, then I would hate to see what happens. When you feel like,
it's watch any old episode and you'll see it's pretty. I didn't get to do my Miami Vice impression in the 80s. My impression of Edward James Olmos used to literally be just lowering binoculars and picking up a walkie-talkie. It's going down.
So
that's
good.
That's pretty much every episode. That was Eddie James in every episode.
I'm doing a rewatch right now, and I'm stunned by how good it is. I mean, there is some 80s camp and stuff like that, but I mean, it's Michael Mann, and Michael Mann doing cop dramas and Scumbags. It just doesn't get any better than that. And I think Don Johnson is my spirit animal. But man, Eddie Olmos is so great, and it's. I mean, he is throwing 120 miles an hour. And it's funny because it's he out-acts all the actors. But kind of one of the good things and bad things of Miami Vice is Michael Mann brings in all these actual cops, all these actual thieves and stuff like that. And so we're watching this episode yesterday, and it's Eddie Olmos in a room with a bunch of actual cops. And he's he looks like God. He's just spinning on his head. He's incredible. I'm stunned by how good it is. And I don't know why we haven't elected Eddie Olmos King, because he's incredible.
We did we did elect him commander of the colonial fleet. So there is that. My favorite thing about that show is all the 80s cameos. Frank Zappa playing a drug lord referring to cocaine as weasel dust, which I am 1000% sure Frank said, Can I call it weasel dust?
Because really,
you know, Bolivian marching powder is boring. Everybody says that. I'm going to do my own thing here.
There was a really good first season episode with Glenn Frey of the Eagles, where Glenn Frey actually cuts a song for the he plays a smuggler and
Smuggler's Blues.
Smuggler's Blues. Yeah. And so he cuts Smuggler's Blues for this Miami Vice episode where he plays this pilot that does runs into Colombia. Really good. And you know, Phil Collins is a recurring character, and a lot of probably the worst actor I've ever seen in anything was the drummer from Oingo Boingo was in this episode playing a tough, and it was a little tough to swallow.
You know, Ryland, if you're a Buddhist, you're gonna have to listen to the two leads' albums after you watch the show.
Yeah. Oh no, Heartbeat. Don Johnson actually had a pretty solid hit with Heartbeat. Don took a couple of bites at that apple. So he dated for a minute why can't I remember her name?
Pop star? Madonna. He did date Barbara Streisand for a while, which
that was what I was looking for. And he and Barbara Streisand cut a tune, that is like horrific. It's really bad. I mean, it's like, you know, it probably took longer to sing than it took to write. And it is so on the nose, no subtext, no anything, but I dig Heartbeat, man. And I didn't know that Philip Michael Thomas cut an album. But I did know that he started his own Psychic Friends network in the 90s, and you can find infomercials for that, and that's a lot of fun.
I didn't know that either. I guess I didn't know much about him in general, except that they had competing albums out. I wonder if there was any strife on set.
There probably was. The other thing about Philip Michael Thomas, epic, prolific impregnator, 15 kids with six different women. Yeah,
also Dennis, women, something like that. Possibly, yeah. And this is a high bar. Possibly Dennis Miller's cruelest joke ever. Saturday Night Live, the week that the last episode of Miami Vice aired, he said, "The last episode of Miami Vice aired this week. That sound you're hearing? That's Philip Michael Thomas leaving the surface of the earth."
Oh, jeez. That's harsh.
The last time you're ever going to hear about him. Brutal. Anyway, to get on to matters, not
just stick a knife in him and move on. Okay, go ahead.
80s nostalgia television shows.
And companion.
How you doing, Chris? I hear you got a new thing that you launched.
I do. I launched a new thing. I'm excited about it. I'm excited to tell you guys more about it.
Yeah. Let's go back to a little bit of the journey to get to Panic, though. Previously, sure. More recently, you were at Heavy Metal.
Yep.
And then when you left there, like where was your mind at when that ended, and what leads from there to Panic?
That's a great question. It was not the easiest gig in the world. I think, the administration that I was part of, we had our share of challenges, to say the least. Mm-hmm. They've been pretty well documented if you follow comics media. Mistakes were made. The one thing I will say about that gig, and I, as you'd imagine, I kind of have to be careful about how I talk about my work.
Naturally. With everybody.
The one thing I will say about that gig is it probably battle tested me more than anything I have
ever
done.
Sure. I can see that.
I mean, like, I feel like now nothing is a crisis to me anymore. I can handle anything you throw at me. Because that was a situation where it was intense just about, 15 hours a day for 3 years. And it was a lot of external stuff, also a lot of internal stuff. But I'm really proud of what we did there. And I think if anything, that there would be no Panic without my time at Heavy Metal. Let's put it that way. Fair. It really got me thinking critically about, what is going on in comics in terms of horror, right? I think there's a lot of folks, some people on this video here, mm-hmm. who make really great horror comics and work with publishers who make really great horror comics. But I think there's not one publisher who sort of put that, you know, flag on the moon, so to speak, to say we're the definitive. And, you know, the resurgent heavy metal tried, and there's new management, and I'm sure they'll try again. I'm rooting for them. I was a fan before I worked there, and I remain a fan, and I would love nothing more than to see that magazine on the shelves. But I also feel like the periodical comics really, you know, we need a steward of that kind of content. And I've been a horror nerd my entire life. You know, it's not a stretch to say that this is a medium I understand very well, and a genre I understand very well. And the partners I have kind of got this mission, you know, out of the barrel. So we're not a complicated company. We want to make really challenging horror comics. We want to make books that, you know, they'll fall into several categories. They're either kind of populist, fun, popcorn horror, which we love. Then there are others that are a little bit more challenging. You know, one of the books that we're proudest of is tackling some really heavy stuff, particularly if you're a parent. And it's really more psychological horror, like kind of what would you do in this scenario stuff. And
that's the Black Diamond book.
That's Black Diamond. Yeah. So the fact that we're, you know, I think our identity in the early days here is going to be a publisher who's willing to take some risks and tell some stories that, you know, very few other outlets would have the constitution to tell. And one bit of feedback I give every participating writer or artist is just like, if you think you've gone too dark, go darker. Like, just keep
it. Well,
make it what it needs to be. Don't hold anything back. Don't pull any punches. And, you know, everybody seems to be having a blast working on these books. And so am I. So,
well, it's you know, it's one of the main thesis statements of my work and my commentary is that, like, genre is actually better equipped to handle certain deep things than regular drama is. And I think that's there's an essay, I did a video about it a few years ago, there's an essay by J.G. Ballard where he suggests, with his tongue a little bit in his cheek, that science fiction is actually the only valid form of literature because it's the only one that really pushes the boundaries of what humanity is and what we believe. He's like, you know, if you look at the, you know, great novels of the 20th century, you would literally believe that marital infidelity was the most important problem facing mankind. And it's like, no, that's not actually true. That's an extremely bourgeois take on what humanity is and what really challenges us and what the real moral questions are, whereas horror and science fiction and fantasy deal with them left and right. you know, and the metaphor I always say is, you know, there's, if you want to make a movie about a man or write a comic about a man struggling with his demons, you know, it's either a guy sitting at a bar staring off into a space, or you can actually have demons. And actual demons is what it, the reason these things work is that that's what it feels like.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like actual demons, xenomorphs jumping out of the dark at you. That's what real fear feels like to human beings. And that's why these metaphors always hit, you know, strongly.
It's cathartic stuff. And what I love about horror is that you can wrap some really interesting stuff inside a horror package. You can use that structure and that genre to make people think. And while not every book we do is going to be some sort of a lesson, you know, that's not our goal. It certainly is fun when it's done right. And those things, you know, the entertainment and structural aspects meet up with some of the bigger picture stuff you want to communicate to an audience. And that's the stuff we're really excited to tackle.
Well, that's why Rod Serling started The Twilight Zone.
Yeah,
he wrote a teleplay about Emmett Till, and twice it just got ripped to shreds by the censors. And he went, you know, if I make him a robot instead of a black man, then I can actually tell this story honestly. If I make him an alien, if I make him a werewolf, no one will look at this thing twice and understand that it's about Emmett Till. So I'll do 5 years of that.
Yeah, it becomes digestible, and look at that, you learn something in the process, or maybe your mind expanded a little bit, or you got a new perspective on something you weren't thinking about or didn't affect your life. It's all good stuff. And, you know, if that's what we get out of horror, you know, that's a reason to play in that genre as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely.
I think you are a very interesting weapon in this game because you are this, you know, you're this encyclopedic, you know, horror nerd, like, you know, and I mean that in, as the biggest compliment, you know, you're you can and should be a tastemaker in this space, but also you have this incredible business mind. And you sort of started to hint at it a little bit. I mean, the comics landscape, I mean, we're seeing it in film and TV also is shifting just so radically. And we have aged 25 years as a business and two or three here. And we continue to change. I mean, what, you know, we'll have you on a year from now and who knows where we're going to be. Starting a new company, a new enterprise, even one as like, you know, as well, you know, you are very well equipped to do this, but you're seeing the seismic movement in the business. I guess, what are you seeing and how are you sort of positioning this company and this business model to deal with that? Like, you know, I guess this is a lot of questions, but it's like, where are we headed and how are you guys headed into this, you know?
Yeah, you know, I don't want to speak for the industry at large, but, you know, I can tell you certainly the thinking that we've been doing because we panic has been something me and my partners have been quietly working on now since I would say maybe May or June of last year. And we really only went public in any meaningful way at San Diego Comic-Con just a few weeks ago. So we had a lot of time in there where we were thinking critically about what we wanted to do and what we wanted to stand for, you know, all those things that are emblematic. I hate to use the B word when we're talking about comics, but you know, we are a brand at the end of the day and we have to stand for something. So, you know, the alongside all of that philosophical thinking, we were, I think, right to spend a lot of time talking to people who make decisions in the industry, and in particular talking to retailers. You know, they're the hardest hit, I would say, at the end of the day, out of all of us in this business, and they probably feel the shrapnel quickest and hardest when there are shifts in the industry and it becomes unstable. And there are a few voices that I always listen to. And the couple of key things that I took away from folks that I kind of already suspected, but really informed our philosophy about how we're going to publish things, is that we don't want to be a publisher that does books that are just ongoing indefinitely. That's one thing that you'll see from us. We're going to tell stories in pretty succinct volumes, you know, almost like acts in a way. And some of these are self-contained and, you know, we'll pick up another volume down the road and it will tell a new story in the same universe. But that's very intentional because we feel like if we're not hearing retailers say, you know, anything, what we're hearing loud and clear is like, just don't glut the marketplace. If you're going to put out something, just let me know that I can count on if you put the Panic logo on something, it's a good book. Mm-hmm. So we're being very conservative in how we put out content. So you'll never see us in at least the first few years put out more than two or three titles a month. We have no interest in managing a front list that just goes on and on and on. We want to have projects that are manageable. And really, we want to devote the resources we have as a company to the folks who we're working with in the given moment, right? Like, we want to make sure that we're there for them financially and, you know, to creatively, whatever they need to be able to see this project through. And, you know, if I learned something at Heavy Metal is that, you know, there were too many projects going on at once and not one of them could be properly nurtured. So that's a big thing that I walked away with Heavy Metal from, and I'm really trying to course correct with Panic, is that, you know, if you're putting out something, give it your all. So being very conservative that way, we're actually going to offer retailers probably a little bit more bang for their buck. Every one of our books is going to be, you know, oversized in terms of how many story pages are within. Most of them are coming in at 30 pages plus. So nice. We're going to be maintaining that. So fewer issues, so we can avoid that issue 3-4 drop off a cliff that a lot of us see. And more per issue. And quite frankly, we're not raising the per issue price as a result of having more content in each book. So we're trying to really provide an economical buy to that community, to the retailers and to the fans. It may not work, but this is kind of the path we've chosen right now. And we feel like it's a good play. I think it amazes me that there are still publishers, you know, indie publishers in particular, who are still pumping so much product into the marketplace and so many yeah. variant covers. I know they work and they certainly get issue numbers up, but I don't think I've spoken to a single retailer in the last year who's like high on variants. It's mm-hmm. just they pile up, they accumulate, they're distracting. You know, I've heard it all. And we're not going to, you know, I don't want to contribute to dollar bins if I don't have to, I think, at the end of the day. So I think that's the key thing is like, we don't want to overdo it. We don't want to put out anything that we don't feel great about. And we really want it to get to that point where if you see our little skull logo on something, you can feel confident that we feel good about it. You know, it's not something that we're putting out as an obligation or, you know, we're trying to appease talent or something like that. If a book comes out, it belongs out.
Yeah. And we should say before we get too far into this, you guys have a Zoop campaign that folks can follow right now. Why don't you go ahead and get the info out on that? And
yeah, I made it easier on everybody. So we don't have to use the long Zoop URL. So if you go to time to panic with a K at the end, PANICK.com, that'll lead you right to our Zoop page where you can pre-register. The Zoop goes live on the 13th of September, which is a Friday the 13th, because of course it is. And yes, we're going to be revealing in the next 2 weeks more and more about what's in that Zoop. But I will tell you that we're keeping it simple, we're keeping it economical, and we're really making it about the three titles that constitute our launch slate, which are Tama, Savager, and Black Diamond, which are three fantastic titles. And we're offering exclusive editions of those with some really fun bells and whistles. And I think the most exciting thing that I can talk about, because we talked about it at San Diego, is that one of the big add-ons in there is that we will be happy to murder you, your likeness, in a comic book.
Nice. Really good.
So you'll be able to get
those. Those are always popular. I learned I learned the name for that, by the way. Did you know there's a name for that?
No.
Tuckerization.
Tuckerization. Wow.
Tuckerization. You know, I can't remember, but I like some writer named Tucker used to use his friend's name in his books or whatever. And that was I did a campaign for an anthology, a Sherlock Holmes in alternate universes anthology. I ended up writing Holmes and Watson as 1970s beat cops in New York City. But they offered what they called Tuckerization, and it was some woman paid a certain amount of money to be the witness to the murder that Holmes and Watson solve in it. So that's that is the name for that.
Yeah. My Kickstarters, you know, I get a lot of these, a lot of interest on the draw me into the book, you know, and, with peacekeepers, a lot of investigations happening, you know, cop circuses, and you get a lot of people investigating. And so a lot of people were excited about being deputies and stuff like that. I've not murdered anyone yet. And, maybe I should,
I'll let you know how it goes. Certainly sounds fun.
What does it cost to get murdered in a panic book?
Oh gosh, I'm gonna have to get back to you on that because I don't have the whole thing open in front of me. But
you know,
we're being a very reasonable. We're offering very reasonable rates to get killed. Let's put it that.
Good. Yeah.
So we should talk about that as you know the model that you're using here, which I've used myself, of start with crowdsourcing, which sort of ensures a financial cushion, ensures a parachute, ensures that you can get the book made and then go to traditional publishing. And then, because I know that, you know, there are retailers who will grit their teeth when you mention crowdfunding, and then you have to say, no, I'm doing it so that I can afford to print the comics that are going to your store. You know?
Yeah. I think the opinion of it all is kind of changing a little bit. You know, I had a meeting with Diamond at San Diego and I brought up our Zoop, and I kind of brought it up in that way. Like, you know, don't hit me after I said it. And they were like, no, that's great. You know, you're going to raise awareness, you know, you're going to get the word out there. And, you know, if you put a few bucks in the bank, that's great. Quite frankly, we're doing this mostly for the awareness factor. We have we're months away from having product on shelves. As you guys know, I have a marketing background, and the biggest challenge for me is like, how do you keep that ball in the air all this time and get to that date and keep the enthusiasm levels up? Because if we announce ourselves in July and we don't have product until March, That's a long way to tread water. Like you're going to get forgotten. So more than anything else, we just wanted to be able to offer up a platform where like people can see what we're up to, you know, decide if they're on board or not, ask us questions. We do plan to be a very sort of publicly available publisher in a lot of ways. So we should be very accessible on social media and things like that. We just want people to start feeling good about what we're doing. And if they support us on that level, great. If they wait till the direct market versions, that's fine too. But we want people to have the opportunity to sign up and hear from us and hear directly from us in addition to the distribution channels, what we're up to. I think that's really important to be able to control your own narrative. Even if you're working with a partner like Diamond, who, you know, you can trust and you know, they've got, you know, many years of facilitating these things. I love to be able to share these details and our collective passion for them. I think that makes a difference.
Yeah. Is crowdfunding an element that you're going to include moving forward or it's just part of this launch sort of situation?
I mean, I think it makes sense. I mean, we have designs to do some, I would say more intricate work in the, you know, direct to graphic novel format on some upcoming titles. And, you know, one of the great things about having Chris Ryle on board is, you know, he was adjacent to all that great work IDW did on, you know, their artist editions and things like that. So we've been picking his brain about like, you know, how could we use Kickstarter or Zoop or something like that to be able to create a deluxe edition of something that we think deserves it. So yeah. I have no doubt that we'll announce something along those lines at some point in the near future. But I would guess probably not until end of 2025 or 2026 at some point. We've got a couple of projects that are on our second wave of books that I think would be perfect for something like that. In particular, are you guys aware of the writer artist Nir Levy?
No, his name doesn't strike ring a bell.
Nir is somebody I had the good fortune of working with at Heavy Metal. Put out his book Bio Ripple, which was just one of those books that really left a mark on me. Nir's art style is just one of a kind. And it's just a sumptuous feast. Like thumbing through his books is just such a delight. I've never seen artwork quite like his. It just, it absorbs you in a way. And it's like he's pulling you into his brain. Nir's doing another book for us called Razor Gray near the end of 2025. Again, another just visual masterpiece, amazing story. And we keep talking internally about how great is this stuff going to look if we do like an oversized book, you know, just letting all this artwork breathe. So I have a feeling that project may inspire us to do something along those lines, but it's still early days. But we're open to everything like that. I think one of the great things about fundraising is like, I think it's reaching an audience that may or may not actually spend much time in comic shops.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, that's really good for us. One, you know, again, I'm going back to my marketing background, but you know, I have the luxury of co-owning a marketing agency that's doing really well. So I've got all this marketing muscle behind Panic, which is a huge relief and luxury. And one of the goals we have collectively between the two companies is we want to make sure that there's a level of awareness for what we're doing beyond the comic channels. You know, even if it's baby steps, like we get into the fundraising community and you know, maybe we're doing books in other formats and we're going to put our efforts into being really strategic in the book trade business. You know, we're going to keep climbing and find ways to reach folks. And if we can't pull them into brick and mortar comic stores, we really want to figure out how to service a broader horror loving audience. So that's always going to be in our heads, that evolution of how we connect with an audience and grow an audience.
Well, yeah, and it's kind of, you know, kind of where I was going with the question is, you know, we have these, you know, I don't know what you call it. We've created these rules for creators as we've done, you know, 100 plus of these episodes. And what keeps coming up is that it's this thing you're describing where it's like there are people that they pretty much only buy their comics in a comic shop. And there are people that pretty much only buy their comics on Kickstarter or Indiegogo or something like that. And there is crossover, but not nearly as much as we think there is. And so as a creator or as a new company, if you are not servicing both ponds, then you're leaving money on the table. You're leaving exposure on the table. You're leaving fans on the table. You're leaving awareness on the table. And as a, you know, I mean, a marketing mind, like I have to imagine that you're really engaged with that and really interested. And I also think it's, you know, when you look at at just the art business in general. I mean, movies, TV, and what Kickstarter has become. You know, Kickstarter, you don't go on and you're not getting a cheap $4 floppy. You're going on to Kickstarter, and most people are spending about $25 on Kickstarter, right? And sometimes that's for a single floppy, but it is a boutique, it is a Cadillac experience. You are getting an extremely high quality, and people expect that. And if you don't deliver that, you're going to hear about it. They're going to find you on social media, and they're going to tell you they don't like it. And that is interesting to me. And that IDW, you know, special editions, you know, sort of connection is really interesting. Where it's, I mean, the kind of reimagining what a comic book can be, what a collected edition can be, giving them a Cadillac, giving them like a really high quality, you know, we're not just putting art in a book. The book itself is art, right? That's pretty incredible and pretty amazing. And people want that, and people will be inspired by that. And people will, you know, then your brand becomes about quality, right?
Yeah. And I think you hit upon something really interesting too. I think we're probably, you know, as close as most people are to like being the Wednesday Warriors, right? Like, we're still going into comic shops and buying books, the three of us. You know, I've never been one to treat comics as if they're sacred, meaning like all of my comics look like they've been enjoyed. Let's put it that way. Like,
right.
To my left here, I've got long boxes full of comics, you know, like a tower of them. And most of them are in bags and boards, but they look like sheer hell. Like, they, because I didn't have any sense when I was a kid, even into like my teens, of like, oh, I need to preserve this. It was like, no, I want to read it over and over again. And I think that's where maybe psychologically, that's where the two audiences differ. You have like the Wednesday folks. It's really about, you know, reading en masse. It's like how you know, I have all these titles that I love, and I've got to read them all, and you know, it becomes about efficiency. And then maybe they're reading fewer titles on the Kickstarter or fundraiser side of the fence, but they're really precious about how it's delivered to them. You know, it's got to be, look a certain way, feel a certain way. It's got to be a good read, and it's got to be something that you feel good about having on a shelf and becomes a conversation piece and all that. And again, a lot of overlap, like you said, but very different consumer behavior, right? Very different needs. And that's the stuff we want to take into account as a publisher. You know, where, and really the overarching element is like the horror audience, you know, which here's, you know, I'm backtracking a little bit here, but I think the biggest challenge with horror comics is that you can't replicate scares the way you would in movies and TV, right? They can't really do a jump scare in comics. You can do that, like flip a page and you have a shocking panel next, but it doesn't have the same impact. So I think that's where a lot of comics fall down, is like, you can't pad a book out with, you know, tricks like that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the psychological elements come into play, is like, so understanding from a horror primed audience, what would make a good horror comic, what would make them go into a shop or support a Zoop or a Kickstarter. That's the stuff that's really interesting to me in evolving this business. I want to really get an understanding. And then a lot of it will be just talking to people at conventions, if we have the luxury of doing that. And I hope we do. Trying to figure out what makes this audience tick, and you can't please everybody, but I would like to be able to offer something to the horror community that makes them feel good about going into a comic shop or supporting us wherever we're available to them.
Yeah. It's such an interesting model, this comic business, because I think for way too long, the comic business was really about meet us where we are, meaning like,
yes,
we're the comic business. This is how we do things, you know, cause I, you know, again, six years ago, trying to tell my aunt in Detroit how to get a hold of one of my books. Right. You know, it's like her trying to figure out the nuclear codes or something like that. Right. But there is more of this, like, well, we need to meet people where they are. Like, again, the landscape is changing, and the way people digest this stuff and it is changing so radically. And that has been the Kickstarter experience for me, where it's and you know, it's a lot of the same principles that you seem to be living by with this thing, is, well, let's talk to everybody, let's see what they want, and let's do that. And so you know, I put comics in comic shops for a while, and that was fine, and that was dandy. But a lot of times it's like, you know, shouting into the Grand Canyon, right? You don't hear much back. Every once in a while, somebody hits you on Twitter or something like that. Usually when somebody does that, it's a mixed bag. However, you know, if you're at a convention and you're meeting these people, you know, across the table from you or on Kickstarter, it's just right there. It's this constant feedback. And, you know, if I was going to put a comic on Kickstarter and I was going to charge somebody $25 for it, like we talked about, like it better be a high quality experience. They better be getting what they want. And I did make it this premium experience where you can get drawn into the book. You can participate in all of these ways. And it has been so rewarding, you know, just being like, hey, tell me what you guys want and I will do it. You know,
yeah.
How can we make this better? What do you want to see more of? What are some of these art tiers we can do that'll really entice you guys, really get you guys excited? And that's been awesome. And that's not something that you could do even 5 years ago, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you came to remark. I mean, you know, this is my first time doing any kind of a fundraise project, believe it or not. Like. Yeah. Directly, we supported some through the marketing agency, but this is the first time my name is on something, and it's a lot of work. And I look at somebody like you, you know, Rylan, like you're a master at this, in my point of view. You've cultivated an audience. You figured out what that audience wants. Like, why would you ever go back to the other model at this point? Like, you've got no one to answer to but your fans. You know, you can tell the exact kind of stories that you want, and you've got ultimate control over how everything goes down. Like, do you personally feel like that's the winning formula for you? Do you wish you were more diversified? Like, I'm just curious to hear your take on your own output.
No, it's interesting. And this is a really good question. And it is where I am at right now. It has changed pretty radically. So, with the film business kind of crashing and burning, like my whole business model is being reinvented as we speak. And so this is the perfect time to ask me the question, because here's the thing. So right before the writer's strike, I sold a TV show, mm-hmm. Sold it to a studio, had three great actors attached who were not just attached in the, we'll shoot this at some point, sort of way that most people are. It is, we will shoot this tomorrow. Once the network greenlights it. And so we had all the network meetings set up, and then the strike happens. Have to cancel all those meetings. And then things just got worse and worse and worse. And the idea was always like, okay, well, it's at this studio. We have these actors who still want to do it. Once we come back from the strike, well, we'll just set, you know, we'll figure out where we're going to show this network wise and we'll get going. And so strike ends. You know, new year, and it's like, let's take this out. And you go to CAA, and they're like, no, absolutely not. Like, there's never been a worse time to try and get a TV show made. And you know, basically half the execs in town lost their jobs. The other half are terrified to lose their jobs. Nobody knows how to make money off of the product in Hollywood anymore. And they're still kind of figuring that out. And so everything is is at a standstill. And so long-winded way of saying, I'm supposed to be running a TV show right now. So I did not have a lot of plans in place. You know, I was still kind of, I still have my books that were kind of in production and I was releasing them, but there wasn't a lot of attention being paid to it. And so now I have time and now I have bandwidth and I want to still be creating. And so I'm coming back to this. It's okay. Well, what is the comic book career? Because there's a lot of room for it right now. And I can be generating material that I love and all of these things. And you hit it right on the head where it is, I am looking at a lot of traditional publishing. And I'm wondering what a lot of these places have to offer me at this point, because doing it on my own has been so rewarding, and it is very hard to make any money putting books in comic shops for creators. I mean, yep. I can go on to Kickstarter and I make damn good money on Kickstarter. Yeah. There's no attrition, you know, in Kickstarter. It goes in the opposite direction. In fact, you build a fan base. It is a fan base that loves me, you know, that enthusiastically embraces what I do. I don't have people noting stuff to death, and I've worked with great people in comics, you know. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to say that it's all been bad. I was still doing some things. You know, I was doing these Immortal Studios books, you know, with Brian Cunningham, who's amazing, and I was excited about those. They're running into, you know, financial business model issues right now. Those books are supposed to be out via Dynamite in comic shops right now. They're not. So I'm taking a hard look at it. I mean, here's the thing is that I think that I need to make a return to traditional comic shops, kind of to reinvigorate the business, right? There's a prestige in it. It's like I said, it is a different audience. And I have not for a while been servicing that audience. And so that can look, I thought I was going to be doing it with the Immortal books, you know. I had the one book coming out, Fa Sheng, which was kind of like the flagship that got the whole slate set up at Dynamite. And then because of that, last Comic-Con, not this last one, but the one before that, they gave me a second book. They're like, oh, Ryland's doing the second book and it's going to be great. And so I'm supposed to have, I am, in addition to be running a TV show, I am also supposed to have two comic books in comic shops right now. I don't. And so what do I do about it? And so I'm looking at that and, you know, it might just mean that I need to, you know, that I need to take the jump or the Peacekeepers and do the traditional publishing dance. It's another thing that's changed, as you've talked about, is you were hinting at it with your Diamond conversation where it's like, well, you used to not be able to do that. You picked one track and it sort of slammed the door on the other one. Now that's not the case, as we see with Avalone's Drawing Blood. It's like, well, if it did damn good on Kickstarter, it's probably going to do damn good in a comic shop also. So, you know, so Image becomes really interested. And so I may have to do that, but I'm listening. I am taking a very hard look at what's out there because I feel like I have, because I was so busy with TV, I have neglected the comic shop angle. So I think this is a long answer, but I feel like you need to be doing both. The crowdfunding has been really good to me recently, and so it is hard to do the other thing. But I'm looking to do the other thing. I have some trepidation about doing it in a lot of ways because, again, like there are, you know, if you get the Image deal, great. Not everybody can get that. You know, it's Dark Horse can be a good situation. I feel like a couple of years ago there were five Dark Horses and now there's maybe only Dark Horse, right? You know, and so there's that. My business for the last 10 years has been generating IP, setting it up in Hollywood, getting paid to write the stuff in Hollywood. So a lot of these companies, they want rights. I'm not really willing to give those up, you know, so that becomes a weird issue. And so I get really interested when a smart guy like you starts a new company and is doing it differently, you know? And so I like to bring them on the show and see how they're doing things. Yeah. I get excited about it. Yeah.
I'm always happy to talk about this stuff and I really appreciate your perspective. To both of you, I applaud anybody who can one man band this stuff, and it is a full time job. Like it is not a pain of heart.
Yeah.
So
and the thing is, I don't understand. Like the Image deal is fine and dandy, and we're having a good time over there. But I don't know how anyone does it without crowdfunding. Like if we had been paying everyone, you know, my pockets are not deep at all. I have the shallowest pockets imaginable. Kevin's pockets aren't so deep that he could fund 12 issues of a comic book, you know, just purely for the joy of it and then hope it makes money in shops. Like all of crowdfunding makes all of this stuff possible. Like I said, I don't know how anyone does an Image or a Dark Horse creator-owned book if they haven't previously raised money somewhere else because it's a big damn lift. I mean the, you know, and it's funny. I stumbled upon a conversation on Facebook where people were complaining about, you know, comics used to be 20 cents and now they're $4.99 and that doesn't match inflation. It's like, yeah, but they're not printed on newsprint anymore and they're not in 7-Elevens anymore. And it's a very different world. And I, you know, not to bootlick for the publishers at all, but I always say, you know, kickstart a comic and then put it in Diamond and you will be stunned at the razor thin margin to make a dollar on a comic book in a comic book store. Like the idea that even Marvel and DC are not marking up comic books to make them $4.99 or $3.99. They are not. They are, the return on investment on those books is very small.
It is.
You know,
it's not a business for the faint of heart, top to bottom.
No.
Yeah.
No, and even, you know, it's great if you know that, well, we're selling Batman and we're selling Spider-Man and we're selling the X-Men and we're selling Superman. So, like, we can also have books that only sell 10,000 copies or 3,000 copies. But if you're not, if your company doesn't have the Ninja Turtles, if you don't have the cash cow, you know, and look, that's how movie studios did business forever. They wanted prestige and money. So they'd balance the blockbuster with the Merchant Ivory Oscar picture. And you hope for the best. And it's, you know, Drawing Blood is doing well, but, you know, there isn't a robust comics press out there reviewing. Like, the first issue of that book got 5 or 6 reviews.
Yeah.
The new book from Kevin Eastman got 5 or 6 reviews in the comics press. That is still wild to me. The degree to which people didn't get excited about it, didn't make a lot of noise about it. And, you know, I'm not a marketing guy. I am trying to, you know what I'm trying to learn what I can and do my best to, you know, be good at branding and be good at being out there making noise for myself. But it's an uphill struggle in a very, very crowded shop. You know,
it is. We talk about this a lot internally at Panic. It's, you know, again, I have no desire to be a casualty of, you know, the marketplace. So that's why we're taking a really conservative approach. And one of the things I've been saying from the outset, you know, publicly and privately, is that, you know, I can't reinvent the wheel in terms of how publishing works, but I certainly want to try to do better. One of the things that we've been sure to sort of communicate to everybody that you know, we work with, is that we're not necessarily out to get your film rights. Like, I understand that's kind of part and parcel now with indie publishing if you're shopping a creator-owned book. But for us, it's not baked into every agreement that we have. That's not to say that we won't have that level of interest. Some projects are a really great fit in that regard and make a lot of sense, and some don't. But to, you know, I do think it's a little maybe questionable to have that as your de facto arrangement with a publisher.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, I realize everybody is doing it, so you can get away with it. But I also feel like it doesn't really take into account the folks who are creating the content and kind of the plight they've got to deal with every single day and where they eventually will make money on these projects. So I don't know. We try it when we have desires to go into that with a creator. We try and find a way forward that makes sense economically. Sure. It's not a cut and paste for us. And we try to be a resource. You know, we do have Adam Schlagman, who came from DC Film as a VP, who's going to make an excellent head of studio when we get to the point where we've got enough IP to constitute a studio. But, you know, I think everybody in what I love about all these folks that I'm working with now, I put a thing in my own head after the heavy metal experience. And that was, if I can't sit on a cross country flight next to somebody, I can't be their business partner either. So if I can sit next to you for 6 hours on a flight, that's like the bare minimum for me to be in business with you. And, you know, all these people are people I would be pleased to spend any time with professionally or personally. They're good people. They see the industry from both sides, from all sides, frankly. And, you know, I think if there's one through line in everybody, is that we want to run a business that's viewed as fair. You know, I would love to run a business that could be somewhat revolutionary in that regard in how we're treating talent. But with the margins being razor thin, we've got to keep the doors open, the lights on. But while we're doing that, we're trying to take into account the hardships on the other side of the table and what that means for us. Because if we don't have folks like you, fortified in any way, we don't have an industry. What are we doing? So at some point that house of cards is going to come crashing down, And I think everyone's going to have to rethink the whole transmedia experience and what it ultimately means to them. And it's probably going to mean fewer publishers out there, but maybe that's good. Maybe that's bad. I don't know, but we'll certainly see. But all I can do is try with the little group that we have. And, you know, our ambitions are to, you know, stay alive, stay healthy, provide something to the marketplace that it wants and needs, and, you know, try and do right by the people who want to work with us. And it's a really low bar, but, you know, we intend to at least start from there and see where we can go.
Yeah. And the, you know, the rights thing is so interesting. And I think you guys are tackling it in a great way is really, it is a matter of, well, what are you offering the creator? You know, when you have somebody who has a deep Hollywood background and can actually show this to people, can actually get it set up somewhere. And then after a few years, when you guys actually have like a very good track record of setting things up and, you know, then that makes total sense. You know, it's like, okay, well, this publisher can actually do something for it. And, you know, for the most part, it's like, okay, well, if you bring me a deal, like, yeah, you absolutely deserve, you know, whatever it is, a piece of that, certain credits, all of that stuff, 100%. You know, for me, my quarrel with a lot of these publishers are, well, I mean, I've set up IP in the film business for 15 years. Like that's my, so I'm a lot better at it than they are. So if I, you know, they publish something, I take it, immediately set it up, and they don't, you know, they're in Pittsburgh. They've never even been to Los Angeles. You know, why am I giving them a piece of that? That doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Best part of the Image deal is the leaving the media rights off the table. That's the really nicest, smartest thing. And I've been negotiating a creator-owned deal with Dynamite, and they, you know, they want a chunk of the media rights, but they are also paying me a page rate. You know, like, so it, you know, it's always, people are like, oh, I can't believe you want to give them a big piece of the, it's like, yeah, they're underwriting the book though. So that does earn them a piece of the, that's always the sliding scale of like, if you are going to be the ones that make this thing real, then yes, of course you deserve a big chunk of it. But you know, yeah, a lot of these smaller publishers that think that are literally just looking for the IP farm aspect of it, they don't, you know, one, they're not connected enough to even promise that. And two, they're not giving you something in return for all of that.
Well, yeah. And what's funny is that we're seeing all of those publishers fail and wash out, and they're thankfully being, you know, replaced by companies like Panic that, you know, that are full of good people that are looking to do right by people. And that's how you get the best out of people. And that's how you thrive. Right. I mean, so, yeah.
And I love your cross country flight, metaphor, because I do think that that's, you know, the vibes, man, like, you know, people underrate it, you know, people go into business with people who wave giant red flags at them because they just want it too badly. Yeah. And, you know, I used to sometimes sit in on acting classes and give industry advice for what it was worth. And I always would say, like, among everything else, the director is deciding if you're going to be someone they can have breakfast with for 30 days in a row and not want to kill you. Yeah. So like, be someone who is pleasant to have breakfast with for 30 days in a row. You know, and Michael Stipe, I always remember Michael Stipe once said, you are better off teaching your best friend how to play bass than auditioning for the best local bass player in your hometown. Yeah. Like ultimately your friend will get good at it, but this guy owes you nothing, doesn't care about you.
Yeah.
Isn't part of the team, and maybe the worst person in the world to be on a tour bus with. So do not take that chance.
Exactly how Panic came together. Without exaggeration, everybody who is a partner of mine at Panic, literally it came from like, hey, not only do I like you, but you get this mission, and why don't you come and play in our sandbox? And the first person I called when I had this inkling was a gentleman named Mark McCann. who you guys may have spoken to him in the past. He's a brilliant comic writer in genre spaces. His most popular title is Never Never, which we published at Heavy Metal back in the day. He's worked for 2000 AD. He's made the rounds. He did some stuff for Opus on the Frazetta books. He's just a great, first of all, he's great at ideation and concepting and world building, but he's also great as a for hire writer. And he's also just such an accommodating human being, creatively speaking, that he wants to make all of the talent that we work with better. He throws himself into these books in a way that is not assuming or insulting, you know, and when he gives suggestions, they really seem to come across as additive. And that spirit that I worked with Mark under at Heavy Metal, it just made me want to pick up the phone and go, you want to do this together? Like, because I just knew he would be somebody who would have the heart for it and the constitution for it and would want to make everything we do stronger and better and more creative. And then, you know, one by one, Adam Schlagman and Doug Pasco, who is our chief operating officer now, they pitched me a story called Tama in the very early days last summer of me putting together Panic. And second meeting in with those guys, I'd known Adam for many years. We worked together at DC. I'd only sort of knew Doug a little bit here and there from other people. But it just became apparent to me in like our second meeting, like these guys would be great on our team. And I asked them, I believe I interrupted them in the middle of talking about their book. I was just like, do you guys want to just take a C-suite title in this company? Like, we're still putting our formation papers together. It can happen. And thankfully they wanted to, and they've been great. And, you know, Chris Ryle, funny story. We talked about this at the San Diego Comic-Con panel, but Chris Ryle and I bumped into each other. He was coming out of the men's room and I was going in at Lou and Mickey's in the gas lamp during last year's San Diego Comic-Con. And man, did I really have to pee. Like I bumped into him and he said, hi, and we're having a nice conversation. And he said something to me. He's like, hey, you know, I would love somebody to just be a sounding board and talk about starting a business. And he's like, I'm running Syzygy and I'm a one man show and it's just a lot. And just be great to have somebody to talk to. And about four of those conversations in, I just outright asked him. I was like, look, I'd be lucky to have you in any capacity in this company. And thankfully he accepted my, my offer to be an advisor. And just to be in the company of these people who are so creative and so selfless, and just so understanding of what I wanted to accomplish when I started this and approving of it. And it, like, it's just remarkable. It almost feels like a dream sometimes, like that I get to just do what I do with these folks and who are just lovely human beings, and just to be in awe of their talent every single day is just a gift.
No. And Chris is a great guy. I mean, on top of all, you know, industry considerations and all that, it goes back to, I mean, you know, this is another thing I evangelize for when I talk about, you know, networking and breaking into the business and all that. It's like, but it's about making friends. And people always say like, oh, people only want to work with their friends. And I always whisper into the microphone, yeah, so do you. You know, yeah. Like, no one doesn't want to work with their friends. So therefore the point is be friendly, be a person that people want to work with. And that's always be excellent with your word, be kind, be meet deadlines, you know, be good natured. Those are the easy things to do actually. And they will make people want to work with you, you know,
No, I was going to say it's such a total cliche, and I'm embarrassed to even use this phrase, but you really are you practically are married to people when you go into business with them, right?
No, like, absolutely.
You know, there's a legal document binding you and your partners together, much like a marriage certificate. And, you know, when I'm going to be running out and I'm not going to be available for an hour, I first text my wife, then I text both sets of business partners and tell them I'm going to be up. That's just how it works. And if you can't roll with that and find people, like, it's the same exact exercise. Do I want to be, you know, attached to the hip with this person for years and years to come? Yeah. You got to make the right decisions there. They've got to be the right people for you, right personalities, and they got to be bringing a lot to the table. And, you know, with both companies, I hit the jackpot.
Yeah. Well, and I, you know, I mean, it works that way with intimate, you know, close business relationships, but the whole business works like that, right? Where it's just like, where, you know, I found myself saying this during one of our San Diego panels where, you know, I mean, we've been doing this a while, you know, at this point, yep. and people know who we are and we know who they are. And there is this thing where it's like, okay, well, is he or she, are they one of us? Right. And, yep. and that proves out over time and we check on each other. I mean, I've reached out to you, Chris, and said, hey, I'm thinking about getting involved in this situation. What do you think about it? What is your honest opinion? And what it comes down to is this person one of us? And you can very quickly say, not one of us, right?
Yeah.
Or yes, absolutely one of us. Not just one of us, one of the, you know, do it without reservation. And look, the reason you're on the show is because, you know, because in our mind, you're one of us. And the reason that you were interested in coming on the show is because in your mind, I believe, you know, we're one of you. We're one of us. I said that wrong, but it's the sickness finally rearing its head. But yeah, I mean, it's funny how, like, you know, particularly just the longer you do it, it's like the, you know, the, I don't know if the pool gets smaller or if it gets bigger, but it gets stronger, right? Like we have a better sense of who everybody is. And so, you know, it's we just talk about it a lot. It is a, you know, it is an ecosystem and people find out very quickly, are you part of the ecosystem? Are you bringing something to the table, whether you're a podcaster or whatever? I mean, when I first met you, Chris, you were organizing the Long Beach Comic Con, right? And in my opinion, I mean, when you organized the Long Beach Comic Con, it was like the best con for creators at that point. It was a blast every time. It was great people. Everybody at the table was awesome. And I have so many friends now because you said, hey, Rylan, like you should do this. You should be part of this. Here, have a table. Here, what are your panel ideas? And, you know, probably half the friends I have in comics are because of those days. Right. And you talk about an ecosystem. That was that was it right there. But it gets bigger. It gets, and we all stick together and you find out who's one of us and who isn't, like, very quickly.
I appreciate that. And, you know, you're really right. I mean, one of the funniest things about comics is, like, I spent 13 years at DC and I feel like I didn't really become a member of the comics community until after I left DC Comics, if that makes sense, because you kind of live in a bubble when you work for one of those major publishers. You go to cons and you certainly work with talent. You got a lot on your plate, but, like, I feel like you don't get out of that bubble very often. You know, if you work for Marvel, you work for DC, you're kind of in that world all the time. And I feel like I only really became a contributing member of this community when I left DC and started figuring out where I wanted to go from here. And it's a simple equation. Like, we may not be the richest and the most financially secure group of creative people, but I think we have our backs, each other's backs, more than any other little industry that I've seen or been a part of. And we do help each other. And I'm just so grateful for it. And I could never go back to that corporate way of doing business for that reason. You know, I just feel like it would be, on some level, betrayal of the community and you know, all the stuff that we've built together over the last few years. And I thank you guys enough for all the great work that you do for the comic business. It's not insignificant what you do with this podcast and what you do, you know, when the podcast isn't going. Even more importantly, you guys are you know, stellar members of this community. I'm thrilled for all your success.
Thank you, Chris.
That means a ton. Yeah, that really means
I want to circle back and ask one question before we wrap up about the marketing piece and where your interest in that starts and what, if any, your training in it is and how you get that piece. Cause I always try to remind people, like, obviously I'm partners with Eastman on Drawing Blood. And one of the little data points about the Turtles is that Peter had a little bit of a background in marketing and wrote press releases for them when it started. And as much as it's the comic book, it's having the dude on the team who wrote a press release that makes the thing a phenomenon. And that piece is always very interesting to me because it eludes 99.999% of creatives.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. So I started my career, weirdly enough, in pharmaceutical advertising in the late 90s. Yes.
Awesome.
And it was atrocious. It was the worst. I did that from like, I'm dating myself, but I did that from like 96 until 99. And it was just, you know, you when you grow up, like I grew up in suburban New Jersey. And despite being a couple miles from New York City, just being in the entertainment world just seemed like something other people do, right? It was just...
I got to interrupt. Where in... A couple of miles makes it sound like you're talking about Fort Lee, but where's the...
I grew up in East Rutherford, New Jersey, where the...
Not a lot of people would say a couple of miles, because that means like right over the GW Bridge.
It isn't far, you know, about 10 miles.
Yeah, yeah. I'm from New Brunswick, which is about 40 minutes, maybe 30 miles from New York City. Anyway, go on. I was just very curious about that.
So I always felt like the things that I love personally would not be able to intersect with the things I love professionally. It just wasn't something that felt like it was an achievable goal. Sure. And I liked marketing. I studied it in college. I did my internship at a marketing and PR agency. And then just for 3 years, I got up every morning and was just miserable working for two different agencies over that window. And I was young and dumb and untethered enough one day to just be able to say, I don't want to do this anymore. And I left a job up and left it, just quit on a dime. And I took a couple months to figure out what I wanted to do next while living really lean. And more dating myself, but I answered an ad in the New York Times for a job at Warner Brothers. Turned out to be a job at DC. Spent 13 years there. My job there was really, by the end of the run, it was about creating marketing collateral in the form of a comic book, be it digital or print. And I got to work with some really fascinating people internally and externally. I got to do a lot of great work for brands, and I got to evangelize the comic book medium to people who had no idea it even existed anymore. So that kind of put me on a path to just be that guy for comics. And that's what informed the agency that I have now. So it's about understanding the audience more than anything else. So what we try to do with the agency is we show people like that fandom is a very big tent, right? You can be a fan of just about anything, but if you make assumptions that the comic fan and the gaming fan and the video gaming fan are all the same person, you're going to be missing out as a brand, right? Especially if you're trying to approach them in some way in their sacred spaces. So we as an agency try and, almost like a multicultural agency would, we try and explain the differences in these little slices of pop culture and their fandoms and show brands more efficient ways to speak to them. So I'm still out there basically, you know, in a broader way, evangelizing what's special about the folks who read comic books and trying to stop brands from making really assumptive moves in that space. By assumptive, I mean things like, you know, pitching a big tent and handing out stuffed animals and being a brand way from the outside and not having any real anything additive to that community, or just their sort of poaching people from it. And we try and show them celebrate rather than, you know, exploit. Go in and make something about Comic-Con more efficient for the fan. Just show them that you're there to underwrite it in some way and be additive to the community. And that's how you start building those inroads for fan engagement. And I think about this, I think about panic through that lens all the time. You know, and I articulate some of that stuff early on. It's like, I spent a lot of time thinking about who our fan base is going to be when it matures, you know, how we can reach people who don't go into comic shops, how we can reach the horror community.
That booth at Monsterpalooza.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's not a lot of comic publishers at a Monsterpalooza. There's
yeah, I noticed that. As someone who writes horror comics, I notice the absence of that at places like Monsterpalooza.
And they're great shows. I feel like, you know, a Panic or what you guys do, like, you know, any one of us could be really successful at a show like that. I hope to do something like that, but I just want to be really well fortified from a marketing perspective for this company. It's a big thing in my life. It's a big part of my day, and I got to give massive amounts of credits to my Modern Fanatic partners. They are so supportive of Panic, and they so want it to be a big success. And I think if I was dealing with business partners who were, you know, any less of decent people, yeah. it would be a weird split in my day, and I'd be having to make some tough choices. But
yeah, there could easily be a jealous, small-minded response to that rather than seeing it for what it is, which is an add-on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my business partner, Colin Millington, who runs Modern Fanatic with me, he'll just send me texts late at night with thoughts about Panic that have nothing to do with the agency. Like, we should do this. Try this. It's just, I'm very lucky in that regard. And that's what gives me the confidence to launch something like this at a time where maybe like it's not the most stable marketplace for either comics or entertainment. I feel like I have good support and I know the product is going to be good. And, you know, thanks to folks like you, I can come on podcasts like this and hopefully win some people over and get them to give us a try.
I think horror comics are having a moment. I mean, of course, you know, as the writer of Elvira, I would think that, but I do think that it's, you know, I see a lot of fan engagement with it, and there are definitely all the time. I see horror fans who are not familiar that horror comics are even a thing. Yeah. And I try to bring them in, you know, to that world. You know, the number of times I'll see Cassandra post something about one of our comics, and just like there are 100 comments and 50 of them are like, oh, I didn't know you do these. We've been doing them for 5 years. Wow. And there are still Elvira fans that don't know that they can enjoy her in comic books. And it's in America, it's an uphill climb because of the cultural animus, for want of a better word, against comic books. And, you know, most other countries in the civilized world take comic books pretty seriously and enjoy them across all ages and cultures. And here we stepped on a landmine in the 1950s and we still haven't quite recovered from. It's literally like one of the last vestiges of McCarthyism that hasn't 100% gone away is the feeling that American culture has about comic books. And obviously we could talk about that all night. And you hit upon something. I sometimes say this as, you know, it's one of those, I'm kidding, but I'm not, at panels, which is, you know, ask not what you can do for what comics can do for you, ask what you can do for comics. But I think you embody that with what you do. And I think that, you know, the best people in comics really do sort of understand that, you know, you bring something to the community.
Appreciate that.
Yeah, it's the only way to do this and be able to look at yourself in the mirror in the morning, you know, and feel like, no, I'm doing it. I'm doing it the right way, you know. But anyway, we should wrap up. Chris, tell us, when does the Zoop campaign launch?
The Zoop campaign launches on September 13th. If you want to pre-register, sign up for more information, you can do so at time2panic. And again, that's PANICK.com. That'll lead you right to our Zoop landing page.
And we'll have all the info in the show notes and everything. So that should be clickable. And
where can people find you on the internet?
Oh, gosh. So if you want to find me on Instagram, I'm at Chris_Longo on X, Twitter, whatever the hell it is. I am at Chris Longo, one word, no underscore.
And Rylan, where can the kids at home find you?
I am at Rylan Grant on all forms of social media. That is RYLENDGRANT. If you're just listening, most of you are just listening. I have to spell it because it's not a real name. My parents just kind of drunkenly arranged letters and saddled me with it. And so now I have to spell it for you. But my film Haunted Heart from Academy Award winning director Fernando Trueba and actor Matt Dillon will be in theaters this fall. If you are listening to us in Spain, it opens this week. And what we found out a couple of weeks ago is that people are, in fact, listening to us in Spain. I think because of the movie, we shot up to we were a top five visual arts podcast in Spain. So hello, Spanish folks. I hope you're enjoying Chris Longo. I hope you will sign up to watch that that Panic Zoop and get some books sent to Spain. But look out for that opening in the UK in September, US states soon. And I have a new book announcement coming in a week or two. So watch the socials. Exciting stuff. Jump-esque, Black Mirror-esque sci-fi. Going to blow your doors off. I'm very excited about it. Check it out. Bring us on home.
Great. I am easily Googled, but my my website is davidavalonifreelance.com, which has all of the links to all of the things. Today, Drawing Blood 5 is in comic shops, find comic shops everywhere, and we're cruising towards 12 issues of this thing, so keep reading. It's a it's not exactly autobiographical, but it's Kevin Eastman and my feelings about life in the comic book industry slash show business writ large, and what that how that roller coaster leaves you after you've gone on it a few times. And also, if you have kids or if you just like fun, beautiful, colorful things, I'm a writer on a show called Bat Wheels, which you can enjoy on Max. I think only one of my episodes has dropped from season 2, number 7. But there will be more of those coming. And that's it for now. Thanks for joining us. Chris, thanks for being on the show.
No, thanks,
we'll
guys.
Catch you all on the next exciting episode of The Writer's Block.
Thanks for listening, Spanish people.
If you're watching us on YouTube, be sure to smash that like button. If you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or other fine purveyors of ear crack, please leave us a 5-star review. And wherever you're watching and or listening, subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. We'll see you back here next week for more madcap hijinks on The Writer's Block.
For more information, visit pendantaudio.com. Thanks for listening.